Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
For me, at least, as an anthropologist, I feel that my most important audience and my most important critics are the people who I worked with and whose teachings I'm trying to pass along to others. I hope, then, that the people will receive the stories well and especially feel that they portray their way of life correctly and with proper feeling.
Regular listeners to Chinook will recognize Dick Nelson's voice. He's been talking with me about his new book, Shadow of the Hunter, and about some of the things he learned about Inupiaq lifeways while living in Wainwright and working on a book called Hunters of the Northern Ice. I'm Paula Schiller with the last segment in this series with Nelson. In both books, he concentrates on the skills, knowledge, and the social relationships developed by the Eskimo people over the centuries they have survived as hunters. But not all hunters are successful, and of course, not everybody is a hunter. So families are taken care of through a system of sharing. Nelson describes how it was in 1964 and how, perhaps, it is today.
When I lived in Wainwright, sometimes when a couple of children would come to visit me in my house, I would give them something. Sometimes I'd give them a little handful of candy or goodies or something. And I'd watch them when they left the house. And one of the things that amazed me is oftentimes the kid who I gave these things to would go out and give it all away. And I think this illustrates the value of sharing in Eskimo society. Still today, even starting with the very small children, and this is the last thing I think we would expect a child to do in our own society, to give the whole works away,
yeah.
That for the successful hunter, oftentimes it's more important to give away most or all of the game than to keep it. And this sharing has the effect of course, supporting the people in the society who are not very productive and rewarding those who give it away with prestige and status. And when a crew hunts together, as in whaling or walrus hunting, the proceeds of the hunt are divided equally. I, a single hunter, hunting with a crew of people, some of whom had a whole mess of kids at home, 5 or 6 kids, was given an equal share of everything we took. They would stack, say, the walrus meat in little piles, and then in the modern system, a woman would stand off the side and put her initials on a piece of paper.
Hmm.
Then give the pieces of paper to a small child who couldn't read. And then the little kid would go around and put the initials on each pile of walrus meat. And then you'd go and look and see which one was yours. The egalitarianism of this system is pretty amazing. Beyond this, say I, a single person, mm-hmm. Everyone knew that I couldn't possibly use all that meat. So then the expectation was that I would give it away. Oftentimes I gave it right back.
Mm-hmm.
To the people I hunted with, or I went out and gave it to old people, or gave it to someone who was less effective as a hunter. So in this way, there is very definitely, and I very strongly today, this system by which everything gets spread out as widely as possible in the society.
The other aspect of that is that there is supposedly little or no stealing and little or no embarrassment for asking for something.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember particularly anybody, say, asking me for something or my being in a house when somebody came in and asked. Perhaps it wasn't done when I was there. Certainly.
Or was it a case of not having to ask, that if you needed something?
I think that's really the point, is that the expectation is that people will give things away without even a request being necessary. Interestingly, one of the things I went through at the beginning was I would give things to people, and they wouldn't say thank you. You know, coming from my culture, this seemed, well, what kind of gratitude is this? And I recognized later on that there didn't need to be this expectation, because, of course, the next time would be, I would be the one receiving, mm-hmm. you know. And so this whole affectation of thank you wasn't necessarily a part of the cultural context. Oftentimes when people did it, I felt they were doing it for me. And this wasn't an impoliteness by any means or a lack of gratitude. It was just that it wasn't necessary because things are so broadly and freely shared. Mm-hmm. You know,
it all comes back in the end.
Sure, it all equals out mm-hmm. in the long run.
One of the things I started out to ask was involved in this idea of outsiders coming in and with privacy and where you deal in the book with aspects of religion and ritual and all these things that are forever mysterious. And how were you taught these things, and how do you feel about writing about them?
Well, I have been extremely cautious in this writing to try to protect any areas that I felt people would feel were private cultural matters. On the other hand, there are times when I decided that certain aspects of Eskimo culture that perhaps had been treated, I would say, poorly by missionaries and others, had been looked down upon, or had people had tried to change it, and therefore some of these things went underground or disappeared. I feel an enormous respect for these traditions in Eskimo culture, these religious and social traditions that others may or may not agree with. And I feel that in writing about them respectfully, I can present a position from my own cultural perspective of these things as not something to be judged one way or another by outsiders, but in fact part of the beauty of this cultural tradition. For example, I think that the issue of religion is a very important one in many Native cultures in Alaska and in North America generally. Native religions have been put down for a long time by people who are proselytizing for other religions. And as a result, these religious practices have either gone underground or disappeared. And only now are outsiders beginning to recognize that these religious beliefs and philosophies and ethical systems are not only interesting, but profound in many ways. I'm thinking particularly of the fact that Eskimo and other Native American hunting and practices related to use of the environment were all wound up with a religious system in which not only was a philosophy of pragmatics involved, going out and getting food to survive on, but the whole thing bound together with a moral system, a moral code. And what the environment is doing to you, for you, is it's providing for you like a nurturing mother or parent, or something greater, a nurturing deity, in fact. And so animals, for example, in traditional Native cultures like the Eskimos were or are imbued with spirituality, just the same way that people are. And what I feel very deeply about is that this wrapping up of your use of the environment with religious beliefs and morality is something that we really strongly could learn from. Mm-hmm. Because we have lost any sense of a spiritual connection to the earth and its resources as a culture. And therefore we behave as if we had no moral restraint on our use of the planet. These people feel very differently. And I think it's a good lesson for us. So I feel more than just an obligation to report or describe these things, but an obligation to celebrate them as a human achievement.
Are you in danger of idealizing the situation and the way of life that you're describing?
Yes and no. The way of life that I've described in Shadow the Hunter is a life way that's in a state of change, as are life ways everywhere on the face of the earth. What I'm writing about in Shadow the Hunter is I think, a scrupulously accurate accounting of a life that I experienced. This life also involves certain problems. One of the chapters in the book, in fact, deals with a young Eskimo woman's struggles with her own cultural identity. And clearly from the story, this woman has had a large amount of experience in white mm-hmm. society and is trying to decide, well, whether she's going to be a white or an Eskimo person. And I've tried to at least indicate that some of these problems and dilemmas exist. And yet, I also chose not to indulge in a long, long discourse on the social problems that affect these people. And I think it's a good question that you ask, because I so often hear people asking whether I am idealizing Eskimo society. Well, if you look at novels or writings about our own culture, you will find those that focus in on good things and happy things and the stories that have happy mm-hmm. endings, and you can find those that almost wallow in the negative, the social problems and the cultural problems that we have today. And I don't think fault the people who write happy stories for idealizing our culture. Mm-hmm. Nor should we, I think, fault those who choose to focus on the positive elements of a modern native life of idealizing. There are social problems in contemporary native societies, no question about it. But I think what people need in these societies, although I'm not trying to speak for native people, mm-hmm. it's the last thing I would try to do. But I think it's very important that we accentuate the positive aspects of these native traditions and indicate however we can that these things are valuable mm-hmm. and shouldn't be just let go of for the sake of pursuing new ways of life. And I think there is a very important place in our lives for the positive and for happy endings. And so I have frankly and unabashedly focused on this part of Eskimo life. Because I think it's not only more rewarding reading, but also I think it's important for the people themselves. Everything I do, I think, is in the back of my mind, is directed back to the people who are my teachers and companions, in this case, in the North Slope village of Wainwright. And I feel that one of the most valuable services I can do for those people is to accentuate the value of their own traditions. And I don't think that wallowing in their social problems would accomplish this for mm-hmm. them. Someone else can do that.
Dick Nelson's stories in Shadow of the Hunter have happy endings, yet they are also highly realistic, filling a gap on the bookshelves for works about Eskimo life that are truthful, culturally sensitive, and enjoyable. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. In 1978, the Judicial Council released findings that showed Alaska Natives and Blacks convicted on felony charges received harsher jail sentences than whites. This was just part of a large study which was designed to see what happened before and after the state eliminated plea bargaining. That was in 1975. Now there is new research saying that the sentencing disparities have virtually ended, perhaps partly due to the elimination of plea bargaining. To understand why the sentencing disparities existed before and what has happened to change that, Nick Maroulis, research director for the Judicial Council, gives us the bad news first.
The research revealed that there were systematic patterns of racial disparities. Specifically, they found that natives and black defendants who were convicted of property offenses, which include burglary and larceny offenses, and fraud offenses, including bad check and embezzlements, received sentences that were disproportionately longer than a white defendant would have received. Mm-hmm. And in addition, they found that blacks convicted of drug offenses received longer sentences than natives or whites.
That sounds rather startling to me, that something that would be that clear that...
The study was challenged on a lot of different levels. The study was given to the court's statisticians to review, and while they did have some comments here and there, they did find that the essential findings of disparity were in fact correct. I think that you said startling, and I think you're correct in that. The court system, specifically the Supreme Court, and also the legislature reacted quickly and requested the Judicial Council to perform yet another study to see whether these patterns had persisted. Don't forget that the study was based on a period between 74 and 76, but was not released until the middle of 78. So in a sense, the data was already stale. Mm-hmm. They asked us specifically and funded the project to collect cases from the time at which the old study had ended, from the summer of 76 through the summer of 1979, which would be three brand new years of data. And in that study, we decided to expand our database, and rather than just look at Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, to go to all 10 Superior Court locations in the state, which means that we now have what we call the universe of cases, all cases that were initially charged as a felony and that resulted in a conviction for all locations, including Nome, Barrow, Kenai, Kodiak, the major towns in some of the southeast cities. But I should note, and I'm not sure that it's clear, that the initial study found that there were disparities in sentences only for the areas of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which of course constitute 80 to 85% mm-hmm. of felony convictions.
Okay.
But we had never previously studied bush or rural locations.
Okay, which is what the next study did.
Did, right.
Okay, what happened there?
Okay, well, our report has just recently been released, and that report indicates very significant reductions in disparities, in sentence outcomes by race. We find that the disparities that natives and blacks had suffered in the areas of property and fraud offenses have been totally eliminated. It's no longer the case that there's an unexplained difference between a native sentence and a white sentence or a black sentence. However, we have found that the disparity that blacks received for drug offenses persists. It's the only area. And our research indicates that even among that class of offense, the disparity appears to only be realized among cases involving heroin. So it's limited to cases of possession and sale of a narcotic, which probably include a total number of approximately 75 out of all of our 250 drug cases.
I'm surprised to hear you say that the disparity is totally eliminated. It makes me wonder whether the first study was not right and the second one
is correct, or
covering up, or why would it be that that turnaround so fast?
Well, first of all...
And so definite.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of ways in which to answer that. The first study was scrutinized, and nothing was found to be in serious error with that study. I think that the second study was perhaps even better than the first study. But I think that in order to be surprised, you have to have as a basic assumption that things don't change over time and that they're stable and that if we have a problem, it's going to persist. I'd like to summarize for you some what I consider to be dramatic findings of differences between these two study periods, looking at, on the one hand at the 74-76 period and now at the last 3-year period. And I think that I have some suggestions after I cite for you what those changes were.
Let me tell
you a few things. We find that the proportion of cases that went to trial increased dramatically over the course of this new period. In the old study, taking the 2 years together, approximately 10% of the cases that resulted in a conviction were cases that were that went to trial. Trial as opposed to pleading guilty.
Mm-hmm.
In the new period, 22%, 22.5% to be exact, of the cases went to trial. And we find that that change was not a gradual one, that trials increased most dramatically in the 1976 period, which would be the second year after plea bargaining was abolished. So what you find is a pattern where the first year after plea bargaining was eliminated, trials went up a little. The second year they went up a staggering number, and then they leveled off at about that figure. Another finding was sentence length. We find that sentences are nearly twice as long for most offenses as they were in the past. And concomitantly, we have found that the likelihood of receiving a probationary sentence has decreased significantly. So, in this new period, more people are going to jail, and they're going to jail for longer periods of time. I think the explanation for those findings is exactly what the Attorney General's purpose was in abolishing plea bargaining,
mm-hmm.
namely to vest sentencing in the hands of the judge exclusively and to take it out of this negotiated process by which the public defender or defense counsel and the DA agree on what would be an appropriate sentence.
Can I suggest then that eliminating plea bargaining is somehow, or with plea bargaining, it weighted the sentencing against the native and minorities who were not as adept at plea bargaining, and that when they got rid of plea bargaining, it was up to the judges, it somehow got more fair?
That's a very likely hypothesis. It's something that I can't prove as a statistician, but I can hypothesize all I want, and I think that these findings definitely suggest, strongly suggest, that, well, there's two ways disparity can go away, and they're not mutually exclusive. One way that I'm suggesting is that the actual negotiated plea process was itself responsible for creating racially disparate sentences. And you ask, well, how might that have happened, or what might have gone on in that context? Well, to the extent that you have two people trying to come up with a sentence that they're going to sell to the judge, I think that they were probably playing on middle-class standards. Native defendants have a tougher time of showing middle-class characteristics than a white defendant. And so, you know, if that hypothesis is true and there's really no way to scientifically test it, it would suggest that all of the professionals in the criminal justice system were equally responsible in promoting or creating this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Since judges have been doing sentencing themselves, the disparities have been reduced. And there's more evidence for that. We found in the early study that a sentence for a given type of offense, for example, assault with a deadly weapon, could range from 0 to 10 years, and people would be all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now we find much more homogeneity or clustering of sentences. That is, that there's much more agreement among various judges on what a defendant should get. And so all of this, I think, suggests that judges do a better job of sentencing. If what you're looking for are racially equal sentences, than perhaps a negotiated process. Another possibility, and I say again, it's not these are not mutually exclusive mm-hmm. possibilities, is that judges became aware of the racially disparate sentence problem first in the summer of 77 and again mm-hmm. in the summer of 78. This, I'm sure, concerned them deeply and perhaps helped to make them somewhat more conscious in the exercise of their discretion at the time of sentencing, especially as it would affect various racial groups.
So they saw that things were not right, and either consciously or just subconsciously, because they knew that attention was focused on this, they tightened up their acts.
Right. Now, I've talked to many district court and superior court judges in this state over the last year, and I'm personally convinced that none of the disparities that we find in the statistical evidence were involved purposive action on the judge's behalf. That is, I don't really believe that the judges were bigots and going out after certain types of people. And I think that the judges were reluctant at first in accepting these statistics. But there are, I also believe that once they understood that the statistics were real and that they were valid, that they couldn't help but to entertain consciously the problem and try to scrutinize their case so that when a native comes up for a particular offense, that that sentence should be, should conform closely to what a, the equivalent sentence would be for white under the same circumstances.
Okay. I know there are going to be people that are going to have a hard time believing that these disparities have, in fact, been eliminated. They could look at a report and say, well, you're juggling the figures, but they know in their hearts they've been discriminated against for so long that they it's going to be hard to swallow the fact that there's a piece of paper here that says it's all gone. How, do you, can you prove it, or can you offer some some assurance?
I would say this. I would say that disparity on the level of race is covers a whole lot of areas, even within the criminal justice system. This, these studies focused on one particular small portion of the total area that is susceptible to disparity.
No, that's the
sentences.
The sentences, felony sentences too, only.
Right. We are now beginning a new study of misdemeanor sentencing practices. Uh-huh. Our last misdemeanor study showed very systematic patterns of disparity, perhaps even more systematic than the felony study. I am here in Fairbanks to talk with some of the district court judges to get some of their initial comments and build them into the study design. But, you know, you have to... I'm sure that a lot of people do believe that disparity persists. Mm-hmm. All I am saying is that looking over the last 5 years, we see that in the early part of that 5 years, there were statistically significant disparities. And what I mean by that is that everything else in the case, where everything else in the case is the same or is equal
or
standardized or is controlled for, then in the early part of that period, there was an unexplained disparity. In the later part, there is no unexplained disparity. The whites and natives and blacks come out virtually identically the same in their sentences. And that should be interpreted in the context of trials going up, sentences going up. So a lot of things have changed. Yeah. Now, that does not mean that, and I'm not suggesting that there is, but I wanted to point out that that does not mean that there's not a problem perhaps in police practices, in prosecutorial discretion, in charging practices, in who gets an appeal. I mean, there's all kinds of other possibilities, but this is a narrowly defined study.
Nick Maroulis of the Judicial Council is following up on some of those other factors which affect the way natives are treated in the court system, and we'll have more about it on future programs. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller. And this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.